From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Questlove, the drummer for The Roots, one of the few hip-hop bands that actually plays instruments instead of just sampling music. As a child, he spent a lot of time backstage at doo-wop revival shows with his father, Lee Andrews. The Grammy Award-winning band has 6 albums. They start a national tour today. Also, a comic take on the Soviet emigre experience. We talk with Gary Steingart, author of the novel The Russian Debutante's Handbook. It's now out in paperback. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new documentary Capturing the Friedmans, about a family torn apart by charges of pedophilia and child molestation. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Part of a leaked report shows that the Pentagon's intelligence agency didn't have what it considered reliable information to locate Iraqi chemical weapons facilities or programs. The report was issued last fall as the Bush administration insisted it knew that Iraq had such weapons. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports.
Defense Intelligence Agency head Admiral Lowell Jacoby said the agency's pre-war work left him confident Iraq possessed banned weapons. But part of a DIA report leaked to reporters shows that last September the agency did not have reliable information to pinpoint chemical weapons facilities in Iraq. Jacoby said a few sentences in the report are being taken out of context.
We did not have doubts about the existence of the program. It is not a summary sentence. It is a sentence lifted out of the text.
Congress is looking into whether the Bush administration overstated the pre-war intelligence on Iraq's weapons programs. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Washington.
The nation's unemployment rate rose in May to the highest level in the past 9 years. Labor Secretary Elaine Chao downplayed the importance of the increase alongside more hopeful signs, such as the rise in the stock market and consumer confidence.
I think the May unemployment rate of 6.1%, while disappointing, was pretty much in line with market expectations. And some may even say that a 0.1% uptick is statistically insignificant.
Chao said it was more important to her that the rate of job loss in the economy appears to be slowing. Senator John Corzine of New Jersey said it's a sign that Republican tax-cutting policies aren't stimulating the economy.
These policies are not creating jobs, and they're not producing the growth. And I think it is imperative that the administration do what it did to its whole economic team, change it.
New Jersey Democrat John Corzine. Investigators showed today that a piece of insulating foam was capable of damaging the wing of the Columbia space shuttle. The Columbia disaster killed 7 astronauts. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
This is the first time investigators have tried to recreate what happened to Columbia using actual parts of a space shuttle's wing. In the test, engineers fired a block of foam at the wing's leading edge. The foam struck at around 530 miles an hour and shattered. Scott Hubbard, the investigator overseeing the test, said the collision took a small chip out of the wing, created a crack 3 inches long, and damaged a seal that connects 2 panels. Quote, "You would not fly with it," he said. The team is still analyzing data from sensors and high-speed cameras that recorded the test. Investigators completed a similar experiment earlier this week on a fiberglass model of the wing and managed to damage it as well. Hubbard said it seems clear NASA should have done these tests earlier, but he added, that's hindsight. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow gained 21 points today to close at 9,062. The NASDAQ lost 18 to close at 1627. This is NPR News. 5 schools from the Big East Athletic Conference have filed a lawsuit to try to keep 2 member schools from joining a rival conference. Millions of dollars in TV revenue and ticket sales are at stake. Naomi Sturobin reports from member station WSHU.
The lawsuit accuses the University of Miami and Boston College of pledging loyalty to the Big East while secretly conspiring to join the Atlantic Coast Conference. Connecticut, Pittsburgh, Rutgers, Virginia Tech, and West Virginia filed the lawsuit against the 2 schools and the Atlantic Coast Conference in Hartford Superior Court. They're suing for financial damages and want an injunction to prevent Miami and Boston from leaving the Big East. Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal says the schools have, quote, rock-solid evidence that proves there was a conspiracy.
Under our Unfair Trade Practices Act, there was unscrupulous, unethical, illegal conduct to purposely and consciously mislead.
Miami Athletic Director Paul Dee says he wouldn't comment on specifics of the lawsuit, but that the university would defend itself. For NPR News, I'm Naomi Sturobin in Fairfield, Connecticut.
The UN Nuclear Agency reportedly has found that Iran has failed to comply with an agreement to report on its activities with nuclear material. Wire Service stories quote a report prepared by the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is to be presented later this month. The report says Iran failed to report on the processing of some nuclear material or to declare where the material was stored and processed. The UN agency went on to say, though, that Iran was taking steps to rectify the problem. The Bush administration has accused Iran of trying to develop nuclear weapons. Iran's foreign ministry denied that Iran was in violation of the Nuclear Safeguards Agreement. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Robert W. Woodruff Foundation for coverage of the arts in Atlanta.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. In the world of hip-hop, where most music is sampled, the Roots are exceptional. They play instruments. The Roots begins a national tour today. Our guest, Questlove, is the band's co-founder and drummer. Spin Magazine included their latest CD, Phrenology, on its list of the best albums of 2002. In GQ, rock critic Tom Moon wrote, "The Roots have never been hitmakers. Their vision for black music tears out in radical directions, encompassing jazz, trance, rock, and Brazilian pop. From the beginning, this group of jazz heads and rhyme warriors have done things differently. They're a band, for starters, working in a genre in which musicians were once thought irrelevant. Their orbit has included activist rappers and rock stars, anyone grappling with what it means to be black and alternative." Questlove, who is also known as Amir Thompson, grew up around music. His father, Lee Andrews, led the doo-wop group Lee Andrews and the Hearts, which had the hit Teardrops. Questlove co-founded The Roots in 1987 when he was a student at the Philadelphia High School for Creative and Performing Arts. Terry spoke with him this winter. Let's start with a track from Phrenology. This is Break You Off.
Yeah, Mrs. Stowing raspberry kisses on me. You looking for direction, girl, I feel your vision on me. Just don't let them see you sweating. We ain't supposed to be involved. Knowing when we get it off, girl, I mean it all. Keeping you feeling till you're taking it tossed. And when I'm breaking it off, there's no denying the fact it's wrong. Cause you got a man who probably playing his part. You probably breaking his heart. He trying to figure the reason you're gone. Is it cause he's superficial? Or is he too submissive? Or did I come along and hit you with the futuristic? Or is it cause you really couldn't see your future with him? All he bought is paper, never took the time but you to listen. You want it gripped up, flipped and thrown to get stripped and shown the way to get in the zone. Of course, dealing with this, you won't be taking the loss. You need to leave him alone and roll with the one who breaking the wall. We get started.
When you started playing drums as somebody who already loved rap, and this was like in the 80s, did you think there'd be a place for you in rap or hip-hop?
See, yeah, I kind of thought it was natural. You have to understand that when I was coming up, the first records that were out were records that were played by musicians. So you had Doug Wimbush, bassist Doug Wimbush, who plays for Living Color right now, and Keith LeBlanc, who's a popular drummer in his own right. They were the, I guess, the Sly and Robbie of Sugar Hill Records. And then Sugar Hill's the rival, Enjoy Records, the label that had the Treacherous Three and Spoonie G, they were backed up by a percussionist named Pumpkin. So I just thought it was a natural thing. And coming up in high school, when the Roots first started, you know, hip-hop really wasn't that elaborate an arrangement. I'm talking about hip-hop circa 1984, 85, 86. I mean, it's pretty much just a drum beat, a simple drum beat, and a stab. A stab would be sort of like the exclamation point at the end of a sentence. Bam! You know, it could be scratched in or just like some sort of noise, mm-hmm. an enforcement noise. And, you know, so in high school, pretty much Black Thought, Tariq Trotter, would, you know, come up to me and just name any popular song at that time and point and just say, yo, play Top Billing. And, you know, because it was a drum arrangement, I knew how to play it. And that was like the most amazing thing to him. That, oh, he could play Top Billing. He could play, you know, The Bridge Is Over. He could play, you know, just naming all these songs and I could play them. I kind of thought it was natural.
Okay, well, I'm going to stop you right there because that's kind of interesting. Since you came up in the era of sampling. As an actual musician, your friends expected you to basically play the samples. You're still expected to play, but you're still expected to play like other people's music.
Right. Well, I mean, that's hip hop is audio pop art, really. It's just a collage of other ideas. And even at the time, I didn't know that, okay, sampling is the proper term for it. For the Hip Hop Nation, pretty much the first introduction to real sampling that we've ever seen was this episode of The Cosby Show when Stevie Wonder runs over the Huxtables' car with his limousine. Well, not that violent, but, you know, he invites them to a studio session. And for the first time, America got to see the process of sampling, in which you say something and it's repeated back to you. And after me and my friend saw that episode, we were begging for whatever that machine was called. We didn't know what it was called. You know, like in our heads, it was sort of like the Flintstone episode where, you know, like the little bird is inside of the machine and recreating the noise. And we didn't know how in the world that happened. So just during Christmas, Casio happened to make a product called an SK1 machine, which allowed you about maybe 3 or 4 seconds worth of sampling time. And, you know, me and all my friends got this little toy keyboard for Christmas. And, you know, you mess around with it a little while. You do like all the curse words, you know, and all that stuff. And then you start getting serious about it. And that's when I would like run to the basement where my drum set was and try and cram in 8 bars worth of drum breaks within 3 seconds, which, you know, you have to be pretty fast to do it.
Right.
And then I just, you know, realized the endless possibilities of a sampler.
Well, while we're talking about musicianship and sampling, I thought this would be a good time to play Rock You from your new CD, Phrenology, because you're actually playing on this, but you're playing more or less a rhythm line from Queen's We Will Rock You. But again, you're not sampling
well,
it.
Well, inspired.
You're playing
but,
it,
yeah,
and
we're
you're reinterpreting it, too.
It's inspired by it, but some artists are a little iffy about sample clearances, so.
Got it. Anything else you want to say about Rock You?
In case the Lords are listening.
Right. Anything else you want to say about Rock You?
Rock You is just our mission statement. You know, the roots are so associated with just a mellow atmosphere. I thought it was real important to start off the album with an exclamation point, you know. So Rock You is our mission statement for the album.
Okay. That's your
Okay.
What I'm about to say, I'll probably hit y'all niggas in a real strange way. Schmucks, ducks, and half-hearted pranks to cruise. Willie gang lengths and use, push shanks and crews. I debut, they made the news and I've been killing it since. Still in the trench, buzzing off the chill of suspense. I want my niggas out that barbed wire, still in the fence. Verbal assassin, I'm a killer, still in the sense. Rhymes is graphic, aiming straight at your mind. Then blast that weak. The pieces and particles of fragments, mad vocabulary. Yes, I must confess, I'm like Nitty trying to sink a slug of Elliot chest. Just taste on that, it's black, you can tell it.
That's The Roots from their new CD, Phrenology. My guest is Questlove, the drummer of the group, and one of the founders. The word niggas is used on the track that we just heard. When is it okay with you, and when is it not okay with you to use the word?
You know, I could play the politically correct term and say, you know, well, okay, we know it's wrong, but I mean, but basically, I think with black people, we pretty much will turn any tragedy into a term of endearment. So, you know, is it right? You know, I don't know if it's right or if it's wrong. You know, personally, I don't think that black people haven't made up that term, but I think that we've turned it around and it's just another, I guess, like colloquialism for brother. To us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What's up, my nigga? How you doing? You know.
Did you grow up with it that way?
Pretty much. I mean, it was natural. I mean, you know the difference between if you're being referred to as, you know, my brother, or if it's using a condescending term,
mm-hmm.
you know.
You started playing drums when you were in high school, yes?
No, actually,
earlier
I started
than that?
When I was two.
Oh, okay.
I was 2 years old. I started the Roots when I was in high school. My father is an oldies doo-wop singer from the Philadelphia area.
Leandros of Leandros and the Hearts.
Yeah, Leandros and the Hearts. So I pretty much, my childhood is pretty much based just backstage at doo-wop extravaganza shows, you know, like Dick Clark Presents, you know, and there'd be like 10 groups, Don and Wine, Harvey and the Moonglows, The Tokens, you name it. If they were from the 50s or the 60s, it would just be a big show at either like Madison Square Garden or the Spectrum or out in the Forum in L.A. So pretty much that's, I grew up backstage
Leandro's,
watching all these groups.
Leandro's biggest hit, I think, was Teardrops in 1957.
Teardrops. Yeah, 57. Yeah, 57.
Would you be willing to sing a few lines from it just to refresh listeners' memories?
I wouldn't want to scare your listeners, so.
Okay, well, how about this? How about we play a little bit of it?
We can do that, yeah.
I sit in my room looking out at the rain. My tears are like crystals. They cover my window pane. I'm thinking of our lost romance and how it should have been. Oh, if we only could start over again. I know you never forgive me, dear, for running out on you. I was wrong to take a chance with somebody new. I sit in my room looking out at the rain. My tears are like crystals. They cover my window pane. I know you never.
Okay, so that's Leandros and the Hearts. So you grew up, you know, backstage and watching your father perform. What sense did it give you of what the music life was like? And then you probably watched your father kind of drop out of sight after the doo-wop era was over. So you also knew what it was like to no longer be in the limelight after having been in it as a young man.
I mean, I was born in the 70s, so pretty much I came along.
Oh, you came along in the
Yeah, it really wasn't about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it really wasn't about it. I mean, even though he made it a career, if anything, he taught me that there is a plan B, you know, and that not everyone gets the plan A limelight.
Right. What was his
plan
B?
By the time I was born, you know, he had met and married my mother. I have a sister as well, and they had opened up a boutique store, and they were quite content. And, you know, as with any music phenomenon that occurs 20 years before, there's an upsurgence of it 20 years later. And I guess most of that started when Sha-Na-Na appearing at Woodstock, and then pretty much after that, just Dick Clark would throw a slew of shows just in the tri-state area, in the New York area, any place that loved doo-wop. Mm-hmm. And my father just made a great living out of it. And
don't you often wonder if there's going to be like old school rap shows? Like,
oh, there is right now.
Is there already?
Totally. And the thing with hip hop is the motto for hip hop is definitely here today and gone today. So
yeah, I know what you mean.
Anything, mm-hmm. anything, mm-hmm. Anything under 5 years is pretty much considered old school. This weekend, I was listening to a popular New York radio station, and they were like, "Now, back in the day, Wu-Tang Clan, da 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 da, old school." I was like, "Wait a minute, Wu-Tang? That's 6 years ago."
Right.
It's like 6-7 years ago. You know, old school to me is, okay, maybe we can say like Marvin Gaye's "Let's Get It On," like a song that's definitely over 20 years old or something, you know, near 30 years old. But yeah, pretty much in the hip hop, it's here today and it's gone today.
Questlove is the co-founder and drummer for The Roots. He spoke with Terry Gross this winter. We'll hear more of their conversation after the break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to Terry's interview with Questlove, the co-founder and drummer of the band The Roots. Today they start a national tour.
Let's get back to your high school years. And you went to the High School of Creative and Performing Arts.
Performing Arts, right.
In Philadelphia.
Yes.
And so that means that you were exposed at a young age to artists of your age of every sort.
Exactly.
You know, painters and dancers and people in theater.
Everything.
And music of every sort.
Boys to Men rehearsing in the...
Boys to Men was in your school?
In the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Always rehearsing.
Was it good to be exposed to so much?
It was perfect. You know, like my first... Unfortunately, I came to Performing Arts High School in the 11th grade. I started, Performing Arts had a private school sector that I went to from first to eighth grade. Then my parents took me out of that school and tried to send me to a college prep school, which was good academic. You know, I could wind up on Jeopardy, you know, you know, talk about the Iliad or something. But, you know, my heart was with music development. And so I begged them to send me to the public school for performing arts, and finally got my wish for the 11th and 12th grade. And walking there, like, I'd never been to public school, and pretty much my only exposure to that type of school was watching the television show Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you're kind of wondering, like, okay, is this the type of school that's going to be like a cliche? Like, are they going to break out and dance numbers in the hallway and you know, to do all the things that you see on television. And, you know, I was, like, real skeptical of it. Like, it's not going to be, like, Fame or whatever. And sure enough, like, you walk into class and, you know, they're singing, you know, Boyz II Men's practicing in the corner. And you have, like, Krista McBride and Joey DeFrancesco trading fours down the hallway.
Wait, these are now well-known jazz musicians.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, like, the who's who of, like, the thespian world rehearsing, you know, their sonnets over there. And it's crazy. It was really a weird experience for me.
Now, like street credibility and authenticity is so important in rap. And, you know, a lot of people believe that to be a good rap group or hip hop group, you have to like be from the ghetto, you have to be gangsters, the streets,
right.
Yeah. And so here you are, you know, you didn't go to the prep school, you went to the High School of Creative and Performing Arts. So did you ever see this as like an obstacle to doing what you wanted to do? Because you might not be perceived to have the street cred.
Well, the Roots are also made up of six other people. I just happen to be the mouthpiece of the Roots.
So it's okay that you don't have street.
But my credibility comes in the fact that when it comes to music, you have to have a vast vocabulary of musical knowledge, at least for me. I mean, now pretty much hip hop is and it's just at water stage, which is you know, just turn on a beat machine. You know, you have a lot of producers saying with great pride and alacrity, like, oh, you know, I made this beat in 3 minutes, you know, which I'm like, wow, okay. Whereas I think that for me, a requirement for a good producer in hip-hop is one that has to have a vast knowledge of musical substance. You know, I don't know, just the cats that I look up to, they collect records, they know certain musicians, you know that there's a vast vocabulary that you have to know.
Mm-hmm. One last thing, I'm interested in your record collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I understand you have a really big one. What's the range of things that you listen to?
Anything. Mm-hmm. I'm just into anything musical. You know, I like the incredible bongo rock group. I like David Bowie. I like, you know, I collect a lot of rare hip-hop records. And I collect just a lot of obscure records that have been used in samples. I'm very curious in the ingredients that other producers have used to make their records. You know, it's sort of like someone going out and buying a cookbook to see the ingredients that went inside of a particular stew. So I collect those type of things.
Do you collect a lot of vinyl?
Yeah, I'm about 27,000 strong right now.
A vinyl?
I know that's not messing with DJ Shadow's collection. I heard he's up to 60,000.
Wow, it's so, mighty impressive, though.
I got some ways to go, but yeah, I'll get there.
Okay, and one final question.
Yes.
How come you wear an afro?
Because I'm secretly a chia pet.
I won't sing the theme.
right.
Yeah.
My hair just grows. I come from a family that, you know, I don't have the patience nor the time to go to a barbershop and get it cut every 3 seconds. So my hair just grows. It's always been problematic for me. Just thank God it's in style now. Imagine me trying to get through this hairstyle in the late 80s and the early 90s, you know. Back then I could do a flat top thing, but no, I keep it. It's my crown, you know. It's sort of symbolic now, but yeah, it was a problem back in the day. You know, people staring at me like, "Oh my God!" You know, now it's no thing because everyone has it.
Besides, you're you, so
yeah, exactly.
You can do it now.
I'm an individual.
That's right. Thank you so much.
Missing Jacksons. All right, thank you.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Tara.
Questlove of the Roots. The band starts a national tour today. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Celebrity, I deal with the real. So if it's artificial, let it be. I seen people caught in love like whirlwinds, listening to these squads and listening to girlfriends.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Easter Island, a novel about two women living 60 years apart by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writer Gary Steingart. The Russian Debutante's Handbook is his comic look at the Jewish Soviet emigre experience, based on his own life. It's now out in paperback. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new documentary, Capturing the Freedmans. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. The immigrant's immigrant, the expatriate's expatriate, the enduring victim of every practical joke the late 20th century had to offer, and an unlikely hero for our times. That's how Gary Steingart describes the protagonist of his novel The Russian Debutante's Handbook, now out in paperback. The book is based on Steingart's experiences as a Jewish Soviet émigré who spent the first 7 years of his life in Leningrad, then moved to New York with his family in 1979. The novel focuses on absurdities in the Soviet Union, the U.S., and post-communist Eastern Europe. It begins in 1993, when the main character, Vladimir Grishkin, is 25, bored with his girlfriend and her torn black shirts, gothic bracelets, and crucifixes. Unhappy with his life in the U.S., after the Cold War, he leaves for Prava, a fictional city in Eastern Europe which is attracting lots of young Americans. He falls in with organized crime and comes up with a Ponzi scheme to take advantage of the naive Americans in Prava. When Terry spoke with Steingart last summer, she asked him to describe the scam.
Well, it's a very complicated Ponzi scheme. Basically, there's these Americans running around who have no business being in Eastern Europe, but who have come the way many Americans came to Prague in the early 1990s to make a go of it, to try, at one point I call it the 5-year plan of alcoholic self-discovery. So Vladimir, being both being a Russian, but one who has lived in America for a lot of his, large portion of his life, wishes to defraud them through launching, for instance, a literary magazine called Cagliostro, which is the name of a Sicilian charlatan, I believe, in the Middle Ages, and through other kinds of literary and cultural conceits. It's a, sort of a cultural Ponzi scheme, which is a term that came to me after, in the course of one's life in New York, one goes to many, one has to support one's friends, and one goes to these bizarre performances and, you know, mime and acrobatic acts, and then your friends go to your performances. So it's sort of this pyramid scheme where everybody supports everybody, but in the end, the amount of actual raw talent is quite small.
Now, this Ponzi scheme is designed to play on Americans' shaky self-esteem. Why did you focus on self-esteem?
Well, because despite being the citizens of a global superpower, many Americans feel themselves culturally inferior to Europe. And I think this may have to do with the fact that America is at the helm of popular culture throughout the world, which is often seen by others as being, well, offensive, for instance. I was last year I traveled all over the former Soviet Union, and here is a culture sort of in the making because the whole socialist template has fallen to the wayside. And what has come in its place is American popular culture. For instance, I was in Georgia, and there was a gentleman with an accordion who sings Britney Spears songs. You know, he has a very kind of old-fashioned voice, and he sings, "Oops, I did it once more, bum, 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 bum," to an accordion beat. It's really funny and kind of sweet, but at the same time a little scary. And I think that that's what many Americans are afraid of, that they are doing this to the planet at large. Understandable.
About being an immigrant, you've said, getting out of Russia was certainly no panacea. We brought the Soviet Union with us wherever we went. What do you mean?
Well, it's inescapable. I mean, let's look at it this way. Jews and Russians are some of the most anxiety-ridden, oppressed, and maligned people in the past two centuries. And when you put them together, Jewish and Russian Jews, it's the making of a mental health crisis. You know, this is, we've been through so much in the past century, and there's no way that you can simply move, you know, you get off the plane at Kennedy Airport, and all of a sudden you are a different person, a person free of these, the madness and fears of these Eastern countries, and all of a sudden you become a happy American. It just doesn't work that way. And I think a lot of people miss that because even if you're driving your Volvo and you have your Oberlin T-shirt on, you certainly are not the same as a native-born person who has these accoutrements. So it's there's no way one can shake off history. History follows us wherever we go, I think. And if I ever breed, if I ever have children, I would wonder even if they would have through my through having me as a father, whether they would have some of the echoes of this terrible, terrible background from which we come from.
Your family left the Soviet Union when Brezhnev allowed Jewish families to emigrate. Did you practice Judaism in the Soviet Union, and did that change when you moved to the States?
I didn't practice Judaism. I practiced socialism in the Soviet Union.
Right.
As a small child, I was in love with the Communist Party, with the Red Army especially, and Lenin. You know, I can still remember songs. Ленин всегда живой, Ленин всегда с тобой. It means, Lenin, he is always alive, Lenin, he is always with you. And as a child, I was very sick, a typical, you know, Proustian kind of sickness, sick child syndrome. And I would listen to these songs and read these books, and I would feel as if Lenin was almost my big buddy, you know. And I would open the window, and there his bald head would be staring back at me. There was one of the biggest statues of Lenin was right outside where we lived. So I was in love with the Soviet Union. And then we came to the first stop for Soviet Jews was, well, it was Vienna and then Rome. And in Rome, I was 7 years old, and my father told me that, you know, it was all lies. None of this was real. And I remember it was the first act, the first instance of heartbreak in my life. I couldn't believe it. I used to play with these clothespins that I imagined were Aeroflot planes. Tupolev is the name of the make. And then I remember switching to Boeing and the Concorde, and that was sort of my first change of heart. And then when we got to America, I was sent to Hebrew school, and we gave Judaism a go. And it was terrifying. The kids would, this was the war in Afghanistan, it was just starting up, and Russians were highly unpopular. You know, remember the movie The Day After and everything like this. So we were the enemy, and the kids would taunt me and make fun of me mercilessly, and I also had this very thick bear coat, and they would call me the stinky Russian bear, much as they do Vladimir Gershkin, the protagonist in the novel. So, you know, so I tried Judaism as much as I could, but that didn't really pan out. So I ended up in Stuyvesant High School, which is one of the math and science high schools, and it's sort of a holding pen for nerds in New York. And there, at this point, I was giving capitalism a go. With all my heart, I wanted to be a capitalist. We had watched Dallas religiously, my mother and I, speaking of religion. JR was a god of sorts. So I tried that for a long time. I really wanted to make money. And I remember in sophomore year, this is so embarrassing to say, I worked for the George Bush campaign. I was a volunteer. And I sat with all these women in these huge fur coats and me, you know, and a small Russian immigrant sitting there making cold calls, getting people to vote for Bush. But that wasn't panning out either. So Zelig-like, I decided to take on a fourth identity after a loyal Soviet citizen, Jew, capitalist. At this point, I decided to become a hippie liberal. And this led me straight to Oberlin College. And at Oberlin, I was very much welcomed by I was a political science major, and I remember there was a visiting professor who would translate Brezhnev's works into Yiddish. You know, this was the sort of thing that went on there. And there, the comrades welcomed me with open arms, too. I wrote a wonderful thesis called Back in the USSR, where it was almost apologizing for Lenin's the way he had treated, the way he had brought the various nationalities into the fold of the Soviet Union. So basically, after all these different manifestations, the real question was sort of, who am I? You know, who is this Gary Steingart? Which one of these, you know, to put it into a Queen's accent? And I didn't know. And it was about this time that I began writing the Russian Debutante's Handbook. And my alter ego, Vladimir Gershkin, this is when I decided to use him almost as a vehicle for exploring this question.
Gary Steingart's novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, is now out in paperback. We'll hear more of Terry's conversation with Steingart after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, Terry's guest is Gary Steingart, author of the comic novel The Russian Debutante's Handbook. It's now out in paperback.
Let me get back to your childhood. When Lenin was your hero and you sang songs about him and
wrote about him.
And
too.
Wrote about him. I mean, this is just what they wanted, isn't it? To get like young, smart minds like yours and convince them that Lenin was an idol, a hero, somebody to be sung about and written about and idolized in every way.
Yeah, in some ways, the Soviet Union made children of us all. You know, I think no matter what your age is, the idea was sort of to put you in this childhood state of mind and to worship a father figure, or father figures, the Politburo, if you will, which never really worked, except under Stalin when there was really no choice. But yes, this is exactly the sort of thing that they wanted. And it's not like there was much of an alternative. You know, there wasn't Michael Jordan and the way you would worship in the United States. They had a monopoly on thoughts. And for a young child, I mean, I don't know how long this would have continued. I wanted to join the Red Pioneers, but we emigrated before that was possible. The Red Pioneers is the communist youth group for children.
Right. Now you've been exposed to, like, hero worship as Lenin as a child in the Soviet Union. Then you came to the States during the Cold War years when in many political circles, Lenin and anything communist was reviled and was a subject of hatred and fear. Then you went to college where there was a lot of serious intellectual pursuit of the history of socialism. So having gone through all of these different points of view about socialism and communism, did you find it very confusing, or did you kind of emerge from that with a point of view of your own?
Well, I think the 29 years that I have lived on this earth have been sort of a grand tour of the failure of these various systems to satisfy their populations. Obviously, America, even under the free market system, does a lot better than socialism certainly ever did under Russia. But one can't turn oneself, one can't simply embrace that as well. One has to be critical. So I think, you know, from Lenin worship to Reagan worship in the space of 5 years, that's quite a jump. So I think I've really seen it all. And my life has been full of these strange juxtapositions. I remember my parents came to visit me in Oberlin College. You know, and these are people who have a slightly jaundiced view of socialism. And they were sort of walking through Oberlin. And there were all these signs, the Democratic Socialists of America welcome you to their socialist powwow. I remember at one point my father was walking through the central square in Oberlin. It's the strangest juxtaposition. I'll never forget it. He's walking across the square, and somebody has drawn a giant vagina on the square. And it says beneath it, "Mom, Dad, you capitalist pigs, here I have tasted my lesbian lover's vagina, and may you capitalist pigs go to hell." And my father is sort of sleepwalking right past it, not saying a thing. Oh, he's talking to the tour guide about, you know, "Please tell me about the rebate for Macintosh laptop computer for incoming freshman student." And meanwhile, he's standing, and I'm thinking, "Dad, you know, get off the vagina. You're standing on this giant genital." And that's when it struck me that the story of my life is so inexplicable. All these endless juxtapositions, you know, from the red flag to a meter-high vagina. It was time to get cracking on the book. And at Oberlin is where I started to do so.
There's a part in your novel where Vladimir, the main character, wonders if the fall of the Berlin Wall has made him somehow more timely in the way that people regard him in the United States. Did you go through that, too, that's thinking somehow like being a Russian-American was almost more fashionable at about that time?
Well, one of my favorite lines of Vladimir Grishkin, he says, you know, "It is better to be patronized than to be ignored." And yes, I did discover that being a small furry immigrant had its cachet. And that I could parlay that. In Oberlin, it was wonderful, because I did feel so ignored for a large part of my life. I didn't fit into any social structure that I can imagine. But all of a sudden, being disenfranchised, as I said during the reading, being disenfranchised was a positive thing in Oberlin. And being an immigrant was a positive thing, too, and I could work with it. So there was that did happen to me, and in the end, you don't feel any better simply because people are interested in you because you don't fit in. This is not what one wishes to achieve, of course. But it was an interesting, anthropologically speaking, it was an interesting experience, and it was something that definitely informed my work.
You've lived in the United States since the age of 7. In what ways do you still feel very Russian?
You know, people ask me, where do you feel better when you're in Russia or when you're in America? Of course, the answer is in America. Russia is such a depressing country and will be in the foreseeable future. Sometimes I feel that I feel best when I'm on an airplane between continents and I'm surrounded by foreign nationals, and this almost feels natural to me, this constant state of movement, of migration. I don't want to bring up the stereotype of the wandering Jew. I hope I can live beyond that. But on the other hand, it does happen to some extent. In this country, I have never fully assimilated into this country. I can speak the language fairly well. But especially, you know, I used to have a girlfriend from North Carolina, and I would go visit North Carolina. And, of course, I went to college in Ohio. And people, you know, as soon as I opened my mouth, there would be this amazing gap. It seemed that our experiences were so different that I even tried to adopt a Southern twang for a while. I said things like, shoo, doggy, you know. but it didn't work. Nobody believed me. Only in New York, when I touch down in New York on an airplane, do I feel like I'm on solid ground, because here everybody's from somewhere else, and it really doesn't matter where you're from. So New York feels like home to me to some extent.
Are there any souvenirs that you've kept from your Soviet childhood?
My walls are festooned with these giant posters. I actually got them after I came, but there are these giant posters, and one is up this... it was called the All Voluntary Union of the Army, Air Force, and Fleet. It wasn't very voluntary, of course, but it was the scheme to get children to give up their lunch money to the the Air Force. And it was this huge poster with a Yuri Gagarin type fella, and he's holding on to his space helmet in this almost oil-like gesture. And it says in big letters, big Cyrillic letters, it says, "Learn to defend the motherland." So I wake up every day, and before I get to work, I see Yuri Gagarin, and I feel something's been lost, something's been gained, and I get to work. And some other hilarious propaganda posters. One is, this would be kitsch, I think, anywhere else, but there's this black fist holding up an AK-47, and it says, "The battle continues, Angola will win." And it's a... it's a poster for the Angolan communist government, and you see the Angola, the communist star, and their symbol, which is, I think, the machete. I mean, what's scary about all this, you know, I idolized Lenin. Lenin was a mass murderer. I mean, the myth of the benevolent Lenin has been thrown onto the ash heap of history. I mean, what kind of a childhood are we talking about when your older buddy is a mass murderer? So it really gives you something to think about. If not right about.
You not only left the world that you grew up in, but that world doesn't exist anymore. The Soviet Union doesn't exist. Your city of Leningrad is now St. Petersburg again. You've been back there. How does it look different and feel different than it did were a child?
It looks awful. Moscow has become sort of a more westernized city, but Leningrad, or St. Petersburg, if you will, is still falling apart at the seams. All the money is parked in Moscow. So all these things that... the trams sort of ran on time back then, and all the infrastructure has frayed, and there are certain streets. The main street, Nevsky Prospekt, looks very Western, is filled with Benetton stores and whatnot. But for the most part, it looks decrepit, and the people look like they've been through a war. You know, often it feels that the Cold War did have a winner and a loser, and we lost the Cold War. The Russian people lost the Cold War, and they look like it. You ride around and you see some grandma standing on the sidewalk and selling a sock. One sock, not two, mind you. One sock. And this is not how we grew up. It was a poor country by Western standards, but there was something like a middle class. And you knew that if you wanted health care and an education at some level, you could expect that. Jews faced anti-Semitism, and there were other barriers. But for the most part, you knew you weren't going to, that the world wasn't going to fall away beneath your feet, which it has for the 250 million people or even more that live in the former Soviet Union. The mortality rate is through the roof. Russia will have a population of 140 million I think in a year or so, and I think in the next century it may fall to 100 million. The average life expectancy of the Russian male is 55 years. So it's a terrifying place, and it wasn't exactly so when I left it. It was a place that was based on lies, built on lies, but in terms of the way people lived, most people expected a brighter future than they do at the present.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Gary Steingart, speaking with Terry Gross last summer. His novel, The Russian Debutante's Handbook, is now out in paperback. Coming up, a review of the new documentary, Capturing the Freedmans. This is Fresh Air. The new documentary, Capturing the Freedmans, is the story of a family torn apart by charges of pedophilia and child molestation. The movie, directed by Andrew Jarecki, mixes contemporary interviews with home videos made by one of the sons during the family's ordeal. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Capturing the Freedmans is a grim documentary about a family coming apart from forces on the inside and the outside. It made me feel depressed and angry and even unclean, which happens sometimes when you turn the full force of your curiosity on someone else's dirty laundry. A few years ago, filmmaker Andrew Jarecki, who founded Movie Phone, so he had a couple of bucks to play with, set out to make a documentary about one of New York's most popular children's party entertainers, a clown called Silly Billy. As it happens, Silly Billy entertained at my daughter's third birthday 2 years ago, and I'm still in awe of the way he held the attention of 25 2- and 3-year-olds. But there was something peculiar about him, a sort of haunted sourness. He's the sort of guy you look at and think, what's this clown's story? As Jarecki discovered, to his surprise, it's a beaut. Silly Billy's name is David Friedman. He grew up in affluent Great Neck, Long Island. And his father, Arnold, and his younger brother, Jesse, pleaded guilty in the late 80s to sexually molesting young boys who'd come to their home for computer lessons. And after the arrests, David Friedman bought a video camera and taped his family's tortured interactions while their home was under siege. Here's a snatch from one of those tapes after the father, Arnold, has returned under house arrest to prepare for the upcoming trial. You can hear the aggression of David toward his mother, whom he accuses of disloyalty toward his beloved dad.
Mommy believes you did it, and she believes you should go to jail, and she believes that she deserves everything that's left, and you shouldn't have any part of it. You have to hire another lawyer? All this woman does is hire lawyers. I honestly have to tell you, anything that she decides, I can't trust. She, Arnie, they don't trust me. Well, we don't trust her. We lived with her for 2 months while you were in jail, and we learned not to trust her.
David had just gotten a video camera when this case broke, and so he just started recording the family falling apart.
The last voice was Debbie Nathans, a journalist who has devoted her career to chronicling suspicious cases of trumped-up sexual abuse of children, with an emphasis on the area of recovered memories. She helped expose the injustice done to the McMartins in Los Angeles, and her presence here is a clue that the case against the Friedmans might not be all the prosecution said it was. But what was it? Capturing the Friedmans is a little coy, delivering its information in teasing dribs and drabs. What is not in dispute is that Arnold Friedman was a pedophile. He had a stack of magazines depicting young boys having sex. It was one of them, on its way from Denmark, that brought him under government scrutiny in the first place. And in a letter to Nathan, he admits to having once molested two boys near the family's summer cottage. What he says he didn't do is molest any kids in Great Neck. And his son, Jesse, he maintains, had no part in anything. This makes Arnold an extraordinary figure for a documentary, a man who has sinned in his own eyes, guilty of one act, but possibly not of the crime that devours his family. The prosecutors see the Friedmans as insanely dysfunctional, but to me, they look all too human. Their home movies plunge you into the middle of something you have no right to see, exchanges that are cruel and damning, yet exonerating, too. According to the same Debbie Nathan, writing in a recent Village Voice, Jarecki left out some interviews that would have strengthened the case against the police and the family's accusers, apparently so that the film would not be viewed as an anti-prosecutorial tract in the manner of, well, a Debbie Nathan piece. But I found the case against the prosecution more devastating for being undersold. And there is at least one scene in Capturing the Freedmans that still eats at me. The morning of Jesse's sentencing, prosecutors watched from their windows as his brothers videotaped him outside the courthouse. Prosecutors described his clowning as arrogant and mocking. It confirmed for them that he was indeed a depraved sociopath. But the tape, which we subsequently see, suggests the opposite exactly. It shows a young man in a hopeless situation, resigned to his fate, yet acting out his rage and his fear in a kind of heartrending ballet. Suddenly, the impulse of David Friedman to buy that video camera and record the death of his family for posterity makes brilliant sense. You might feel like a voyeur watching Capturing the Friedmans, but the circus it depicts is like nothing you've seen in a documentary before. It's Silly Billy's long day's journey into night.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback, The Emperor of Ocean Park, by Stephen Carter. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Shortly after the end of the Iraq War, wildlife conservationist Stephen Bogner arrived at the Baghdad Zoo. Only 32 of the 600 zoo animals remained. The rest were stolen or roaming the streets, and those at the zoo were suffering from malnutrition and dehydration. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Stephen Bogner about his rescue and recovery effort. Join us for the next Fresh Air.